Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani and IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show for all of you today. My guest will be Jay Feldman. He's the executive director of Beyond Pesticides. And I'll be inviting him on in just a little bit. And we'll be talking about a great conference they have coming up next weekend. So stay tuned for that. But first, I want to go over some things that are going on in the news that you want to know about, and some things, some ways that you can take action to get involved in making things a little bit better. I know it's overwhelming. I mean, if any of you are like me, when you pick up the paper and you just take a look at what's going on, you just can't believe it. I mean, I can't believe some of the things that we're still discussing, things that I thought were settled years ago, like abortion rights and women's rights, and I don't know, so many of the issues that were, you know, the Environmental Protection Agency. I mean, Nixon set that up, and we are just in danger of all of these agencies being corrupted by the likes of oil and big industry. It's just horrible. But anyway, this week I actually wrote about a few things that I wanted to share with you. The Cornucopia Institute, which is a great organization that I really like, they came out with a scorecard really rating organic certifiers. And this is something that I really just really realized. I just assumed that if something was rated organic, that all of the organic certifiers kind of used the same standards to decide if something's organic. Well, the original organic standards boards, when the National Organic Standards Boards was set up back in the early 1990s, you know, farmers had been dealing with what really makes something organic for years prior to that. And they had come up with a whole bunch of standards, and that was adopted by the National Organic Standards Board. And that is kind of what they used as their guidepost. And there was a group of people that were made up of farmers and producers, you know, and government people that went into this standards board to decide on the regulations. Well, over the years, that's been infiltrated by, you know, food industry, agribusiness people, and they have really pushed to weaken the standards. And there are organic certifiers out there, NOFA New York being one of them, that really still upholds the old organic standards. And so as a result, they're a little stricter as to what they will pass as being certified organic than some others. And a lot of the organic foods that we get are being certified by certifiers that really do not uphold all of the standards that we expect. You know, in the new laws, you know, where they were proposing that an organic chicken had at least 1.5 feet of space, which, if you think about it, that is so little to start with, that was taken away. They're supposed to have access to outdoors. Well, as long as there's a door somewhere in that big factory farm, they consider they have access to outdoors, even if they can never get to that door. Doesn't really matter. So, you know, if your eggs are really pasture-raised and really organic, of course, Cornucopia also has a list of that. But it's really interesting to just take a look at this list of the organic certifiers and really see which ones are doing their job. It's really amazing. Food and Water Watch came out with a new report on ways that we can create jobs while reducing greenhouse gas emissions. You might find that interesting. And then there's a really great little video, only 3 minutes, that I put on talking about global trade. And it's just ridiculous how many things are produced here, sent to China to be processed, and then come back here. You know, also, if you look at, you know, we send, you know, hundreds of thousands of pounds of potatoes, maybe millions of pounds of potatoes to China, and then they send those different potatoes back to us. I mean, the imports and exports are almost equal, and we just have this business going on of trading that just seems ridiculous. So take a look at this video. I think you'll all find it pretty interesting. I'd also like to ask you all to take some action. And that is one thing that I always talk about, because the food industry, the agribusinesses, the pesticide companies, they have so much money behind them. They have so many lobbyists in Washington that it is really hard for us to get our word in there. And the only way that we can do it is by masses of people coming together. We have so many grassroots organizations. We need to find an umbrella and come together so that we really have a strong movement so that we can push against some of these horrible injustices that are being forced on us. And so there are things that you can do. One thing that I'm sure I'll talk about with my guest today is the coating that they put on top of seeds. I mean, I've talked about pesticides so often, spraying pesticides, but again, did you have any idea that they actually coat seeds with the pesticide and then they don't even have to label it as a pesticide because they're just coated so that it's in the seed, in the plant when the plant grows up, and it's just killing all of our bees and our butterflies. And, you know, without the pollinators, our food system will look very different. So please sign on to that. There's also a sign on to support the Clean Water Act and the Green New Deal. We need to support those kind of ideas. I mean, the Clean Water Act has already passed. It's, of course, our new government that is trying to undo it, like they're trying to undo so many things. And then this past week, I was at NOFA New York, which stands for the Northeast Organic Farming Association board meeting. And we were really looking at food justice and racism in the food system. And it's just a really important topic that we all really take a look at and see how it impacts our lives, what we can do to really make food justice and racism come to the surface so we can talk about it and try to undo how it is built into our food system. And so NOFA New York is supporting an agricultural justice project, trying to get farmers to really look at racism and food justice in the food system. And they have a whole survey that they're doing. And so if you know of a farmer who would like to participate in that, please check that out as well. Some things you want to know about coming up this week. If you are in the New England area, up at University of Massachusetts in Amherst, there's a New England Farm to Institution Summit. And this is an incredible movement that is, you know, there's areas all across the country doing this, really looking at ways that institutions can partner with farms to really get more local and healthy food into the institutions, whether we're talking about schools, hospitals, government buildings. But we're really trying to build up the local food movement. It's good for the farmers, and it's, of course, good for the students and the patients in hospitals. Sometimes they have the worst food. Wellness in the Schools is having their annual gala. Prices are a little steep, starting at $400, but if you can manage it, it's a great event. It's going to be at a beautiful space with water views down in at the Bay Room in Manhattan, which is down on Liberty Street. It's up on the 60th floor, so you have panoramic views of the water. It's beautiful, and you'll have tastings from over 30 of the top New York chefs. A great conference coming up that we will be talking about some more when my guest comes on is called Beyond Pesticides. It's the 37th National Pesticide Forum, and that's taking place at the New York Academy of Medicine. Tickets are very reasonable, starting at $25 and going up. And this is going to be a great event, really bringing people together, talking about pesticides and how we have to reduce them in our environment, what we can do. And I'm sure many of you heard about the new award of millions of dollars to this is now the second court ruling where they awarded the plaintiff millions of dollars for being contaminated by Monsanto's Roundup. It causes cancer, and you know, Monsanto's new owner Bayer is really trying to dispute that. But I think the cards are in, and there's thousands of more lawsuits pending. So that's going to be an interesting thing to watch. Slow Food East End is having a movable feast on April 7th out on the East End of Long Island. And that's hosting, that the host is the Joshua Levine Memorial Foundation and Slow Food East End. So that's always a great event. Long Island CSA Fair is coming up on April 13th. I'm very involved in organizing that. We have over 20 farmers displaying their CSA programs. And CSA stands for Community Supported Agriculture, and it is really one of the best ways to get organic vegetables and organic foods into your home at a reasonable price and a fair price. And what it is you actually purchase a share of the week's harvest ahead of time so that the farmer gets the money now when they need it to buy seeds and inputs and all the things that they need for their farm. And then for the rest of the season, you get a week of fresh harvested vegetables. And the programs vary. Some of them you really have to pay all up front. Some have payment plans. Some have add-ons where you can add on organic meat. You can add on flowers. You can add on organic eggs, bread. So they all run a little bit differently, and that's why it's so nice to have them all coming together under one roof so you can find out which one is closest to your home, more convenient. Again, there's so many different issues when you're talking about CSA programs. So please save, mark your calendars for April 13th and join us at the Long Island CSA Fair. And then the last one that I want to talk about, and I have lots, all these events on my website and many more going into the spring season, but the last one is April 15th. Edible Schoolyard is having their spring benefit, also very pricey, but a wonderful organization worth supporting if you can manage it. And now I want to share with you my recipe for the week before I invite Jay Feldman on. this week, you know, I really didn't have a recipe together, and I was just making lunch, and all of a sudden I was like, well, my quick little lunch would be a great recipe. Because many of us sometimes don't have the time to really make an elaborate meal. And I just felt like a sandwich. And it's funny, with all of the things going on in the news, sometimes I find myself overwhelmed with sadness. And some comfort food is really, really, you know, just picks me up. And this is a real comfort food sandwich. And so I buy the field roast meatloaf. It's really a block of seitan is what it is. But Field Roast is a great company. They also make sausages and things like that. And so it's for a quick sandwich, I use the field roast, and I cut that really sliced thin. And I used about half a package to make two sandwiches. You want a little olive oil, a little tamari. I used about a half a cup of organic sauerkraut and a half a cup of organic kimchi. I used 1 tablespoon of spiced chili peppers that I have in my refrigerator. This is like a condiment sandwich. 2 tablespoons of sliced pepperoncini pickles, 1 avocado, 4 small ripe tomatoes. I had these really beautiful, they're not cherry tomatoes, they're bigger than cherry tomatoes, but smaller than those vine ripe on a vine, you know, red tomatoes. But they're really, I don't know, about a dollar coin size. Anyway, so I used about 4 of those. But any ripe tomatoes, heirloom tomatoes would be good. Sliced pickles. I had some whole wheat sourdough baguette, which is what I use. I had some mustard and some vegan mayo. And so I sliced the field roast really thin, and I sauteed it in just a little bit of olive oil until they were crisp on both sides. So halfway through, I turned them. I moved them around the pan because, of course, the center of my pan is a little hotter and the edges, so that I got them all equally brown and crispy. And then just at the very end, I sprinkled on some tamari, which just sizzles in the hot pan and you know, and really sears the pieces of field roast really beautifully. And then I remove them from the pan, place them on a paper towel to absorb any extra oil, and I use the same pan. I just wiped it out with a little paper towel. I put the sauerkraut, the kimchi, and the spiced chili peppers right into the pan to make that warm, too, because I didn't want it to be cold right out of the refrigerator. Put that in the pan, and then I layered it up on the baguette. I coated the baguettes with the mayo and the mustard. Then I put down the field roast seitan. Then I put the tomatoes and the avocados on. Then I put the kimchi and sauerkraut mixture on. I topped it with some sliced pickles, and yum. So easy, so quick, and just really satisfying and delicious. I have the recipe will be coming out, and I also posted it on Instagram, IEAT_green. If you want to check out my Instagram page, we made a little story of it, so you can see it build up right there. Pretty cool. Okay, and now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you my guest today. Jay Feldman is the executive director of Beyond Pesticides. He's also one of the co-founders of the organization, and he's served as its director since 1981. And he will be at the conference this weekend, Beyond Pesticides, and I'll let him tell us more about that. But Jay's, you know, dedicated, you know, most of his career to finding solutions to the pesticides problems after he saw some of the devastation that they caused. In 1978, Jay worked with farm workers and small farmers after receiving an EPA grant, the Environmental Protection Agency, grant for the organization Rural America. And he worked there from 1977 to 81. And that work inspired him to launch Beyond Pesticides to assist local groups and impact national pesticide policy. And since then, he has tracked specific chemical effects, regulatory actions, and has affected pesticide law. And in September 2009, the U.S. Department of Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack, who was a questionable Department of Agriculture secretary, he appointed Jay to the National Organic Standards Board, and there he completed a five-year term. So he'll be able to talk to us also about some of the work of the National Organic Standards Board, which I mentioned earlier. So, Jay, are you with me?
Yes, I am. Hi, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks so much for joining me.
Yes, pleasure to be here.
I have lots of questions for you. I love the work that you're doing, of course. I'm so passionate about getting pesticides under control. I thought maybe we could just start, maybe you could just tell us a little bit more about the founding of Beyond Pesticides and your inspiration in getting that going.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. My real focus at the organization you mentioned, Rural America, at the time, which was founded as an advocacy organization on behalf of small town and rural people, because of disproportionate lack of access to health care and housing and disproportionate hazards, I was pulled into the whole pesticide issue and had the opportunity to travel and meet with farm workers in labor camps and small farmers and talk to them about chemical contamination. And we really, you know, we traveled across the country and mostly in the southern tier, Florida, Texas, and then California. And we were gaining a lot of momentum. This was under President Carter, so much so that conservative members of Congress descended on the White House and told them they shouldn't be funding a radical group like ours. So the project was defunded in the middle of it. And at that point, I was both emotionally and substantively invested in this issue, having seen the horrific effects of pesticides firsthand in the field and spoken to people who suffered as a result of exposure, that, you know, there was nothing else for me to do except to try to start an advocacy effort. I didn't know it would become an organization, but it did, and here we are having our 37th National Pesticide Forum. The forum concept came out of the meetings that EPA supported, actually, when I was traveling for about 2 years, meeting with farm workers and so forth, and we held forums in which farm workers would come and have an opportunity to speak directly to regulators and elected officials in some cases and talk about their experiences, which became really a difficult process because many of the growers would show up and threaten the workers and say, if you speak today, you'll lose your job. But we did have an opportunity to capture a lot of the experiences And that resulted, despite President Carter not getting reelected, the next administration under Reagan did adopt the Farm Worker Protection Standard, which was based on our field hearings. We called them field forums, that created the justification, the rationale. Up until that point, farm workers were covered by what, like a half a page in the Code of Federal Regulations. Do not reenter the field until the sprays have settled and the dusts have dried, or the sprays have dried and the dusts have settled. And that was it. That was it. And now there's, you know, more restrictions on protective equipment, access to hand washing and sanitation facilities, better, you know, evaluation of the chemicals. I'm not saying it's good, you know. I mean, obviously we're still not offering adequate protection for workers that are the first in line of exposure. So we think we must think about that when we are in the grocery store and making decisions on what food commodities to buy. It's not just a question of what are the residues on that product. It's a question of how it was grown. How were the workers that helped grow, harvest, process the food treated? How are they treated? What are the impacts on the communities in which the chemicals are used? And if we take it back a step, where the chemicals are produced, you know, think of Cancer mm-hmm. Alley in Louisiana, right, where there's tremendous pollution and emissions associated with pesticide production facilities. So that's a little bit about the background. You know, we basically began without any money and just sort of said, you know, we want to use this information and begin putting pressure on decision makers to do the right thing with all our naivete at that time back 35 years ago. So, you know, obviously the issue has grown tremendously since then. The organic industry did not exist for all intents and purposes. That was our mm-hmm. vision of the solution back then, that we believed that organic was the solution to this problem, mm-hmm. that we needed a systemic, institutionalized solution, that the process of what we call whack-a-mole regulation, banning one chemical after the next, yeah, it provides an opportunity to educate the public, but it doesn't solve the problem long term. It just moves mm-hmm. it to the next chemical.
Right. I want to actually ask you a question about something you just mentioned, because I had never heard of Cancer Alley in Louisiana. Can you just mention that? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's the area between New Orleans and
I always think of the problems that pesticides create, but I never actually think that where the pesticides are being produced is actually also causing cancer.
Yes. Yeah, this is the area between New Orleans and Baton Rouge. If you're ever down in that area, it really is eye-opening to drive the highway between the two cities, and you'll see chemical plant after chemical plant after chemical plant. And, you know, what are called fence line communities, those communities that are and contiguous to those facilities are suffering disproportionate adverse health issues as a result of emissions coming out of those plants and contamination of waterways. You know, when we wrote the Organic Foods Production Act, we basically said this is not just an act about safe food. This is an act about cradle-to-grave impacts associated with the food production system. And so when we evaluate an allowable input, whether it's a mined material or it's a synthetic allowed in organic, we have to evaluate where it's produced, how it's produced, impacts on the communities where it's produced, on the workers where it's produced. That is required by law. And that is part of the technical evaluation that goes on in determining whether the material should be allowed. Yes, the focus is on what's going on the farm, you know, soil management, impacts on biodiversity, on those who are part of the food production system. All of that is taken into account and key. But we look beyond that to the impact of the whole system of production and transportation and disposal, the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And that includes, you know, the concern about communities where materials are produced.
Mm-hmm. Well, so often I, you know, talk about how I feel like our country allows almost anything to enter the market. You know, I mean, we've seen so often how, you know, they allow the producers to do their own testing, and then it's up to the public in our country to then prove that it's unsafe and get it off the market, which is different than how it is done in many of the European countries where they have to prove it's safe first. Can you talk a little bit about about the inadequacies in our testing process before they put it on the market?
Yeah, I think your points are well taken in terms of asking the question, are the processes in place adequately protective of health and the environment? And that starts with questions around registering a chemical at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. The authority to evaluate, the responsibility and mandate, really, to evaluate products before they come on the market is given to EPA and the states. So the states can, and many do, play a role in doing some of their own evaluations, and the states can adopt standards that are more restrictive. Now, just the other day, it was reported in the media that the current administration is trying to take away state authority. That has been a long-running issue, and we can talk a little later about the authority that is given to localities as well, which is under federal law, but taken away in most cases, like New York State, taken away from the local jurisdictions. It's a little fuzzy in New York, but there has been an interpretation of law by the lead agency, which is the Department of Environmental Conservation, that they are preempted. That is, local jurisdictions, cities, towns, counties, are preempted from restricting pesticides on private lands. But going back to the federal system, it all starts with an application by a chemical company to EPA to register the pesticide, and the process that the agency goes through with the chemical company is all secret, proprietary, until that product hits the market. So we cannot participate in any informed way with the regulatory process leading up to the registration of that product. EPA announces that it's, you know, has allowed the product or it's received an application, but we can't see any of the underlying data that supports that. And there are protocols that are required for the manufacturers to get these products on the market. And that's where the deficiency starts. You can imagine when you think about introducing a toxic chemical into the food chain or into the soil or into a lake or spraying trees or even spraying for insect-borne diseases like West Nile virus or Lyme disease. What you're doing is you're just adding to the toxic body burden. You're adding to the toxic burden that the environment receives as well as we receive. And, of course, that means there are mixtures of chemicals. And EPA does not test for mixtures. EPA does not test for synergism. You know, that is the implication and the truism that often chemicals mix together create a greater, more potent adverse effects than the individual effects that would occur on their own. So from a scientific perspective, right from the get-go, we have to acknowledge that the review process, the protocol that a manufacturer subjects the chemicals to in the testing process is limited. Inadequate in many ways, but it creates a high degree of uncertainty. We don't have as much information as we should. We often don't have information, most often on vulnerable population groups. So if you have a pre-existing condition, let's say you have cancer, or you have a neurological disease, you have asthma, or your child has a learning disability, these chemicals, when they're registered, don't take into account those vulnerabilities, those pre-existing conditions. What they're assuming is that everybody exposed is a healthy, average adult male.
Right, so they're also not taking into consideration the toxicity level of a baby, right, or a child, right?
Right.
It's based
well,
on adult male.
Actually, the law was amended. The law was amended in 1996. And, you know, you would think that an agency like EPA, that's a scientific agency, would scientifically, in coming up with their regulations, say right from the start, look, we have to look at vulnerable populations, and we should start with children. And it took an act of Congress to require EPA to evaluate children. But the truth is that they don't have data often for impacts on children, and so they apply an additional margin of safety, meaning they come up with a number for the average adult. They say, well, we don't have adequate data, or we have some adequate data, not enough. So we'll apply a fivefold margin of safety, meaning they take that number and they apply it, they multiply it times 10 or 5, whatever number they decide is appropriate, and they create, a more restrictive standard with that higher number. So it's a crapshoot, right? So if you don't have complete information, and you apply an additional margin of safety by tightening up on the allowed residue in your food or the allowance of how much can be in water, how much, meaning micrograms per cubic meter, or, the level of, they do it in parts per billion or parts per million of residue in your food. Let's say you don't know what the impact is on a child, and then you multiply that unknown times 10. That doesn't make me feel confident. It's not very scientific, really, that you've created.
I have a question for you, though.
Yeah.
I actually thought that the EPA has no money to do any of their own testing anyway, and that
they just accept the testing
from the chemical company. The chemical company says, we've tested it, and we say it's safe, and the EPA goes, okay, and they stamp it. Just like they do with the planes and everything else.
Yeah. Well, as I said, there's a protocol. The manufacturers are supposed to comply with that protocol. And when I first started working on this whole issue, there's something called the industrial biotest scandal. All the chemicals that were registered by and tested by the manufacturers in accordance, you have to give them credit, there is a public protocol that must be met, and the labs are supposed to be certified, whether it's an industry lab or it's a contract laboratory. And all that data is produced and under the authority is directed by the chemical companies in accordance with these restrictions that are, we call, protocol under federal law. So the history is a very complicated one, and one that doesn't yield a lot of confidence, I think, in the process, because from the very get-go of this process, it was found that the lab being used by most of the chemical companies was producing fraudulent data. All those tests have been redone, but it took decades. It literally took decades for the tests to be redone, and there have been other scandals over the years of testing laboratories. EPA doesn't do a lot of oversight of those laboratories. When they do inspections, they are not unannounced inspections. But they did catch this lab. It was a lab out of Chicago, the Chicago area. And the owners went to jail eventually. But you're right. I mean, this is a weakness that the chemical companies have control over the testing procedures, even though the federal government, EPA, establishes the guidelines, the requirements for testing. It is a problem. Now, when that data package gets, which is hundreds of pages, gets to EPA, the question is exactly right, as you say. What is the capacity of the agency to actually review those studies? Because we're looking at animal studies, risk assessments, interpretation of data. What does that data mean? And, of course, that interpretation part is the key part. I mean, you can take laboratory animal data. You know, these are animal studies that dose animals with exposure to these chemicals, which is another horrible part of the story. And you can extrapolate from that data as to what the effect on humans will be. But that's interpretive information. You know, it has to be interpreted. And so, yeah, there are weaknesses in the system. There are weaknesses in terms of what's required of the testing. And one of the major weaknesses is that we really don't have in place yet a complete system to evaluate endocrine disruption. And this is something we read about a lot in the news, endocrine disruptors. We hear most about it in the context of plastics, baby bottles. These are chemicals that are in the plastics and they get out, they affect the endocrine system, which is the message system for our body, so it controls all the organs in our body. And it turns out with endocrine disruptors, as opposed to your more conventional toxic chemical, that there's a different relationship between dose and effect. So, you know the saying, the dose makes the poison, and the industry has always said in the press for years, you know, oh, wow, that's like a drop of pesticide in an Olympic-sized swimming pool. That's the exposure you're getting. And as a result, you know, it's de minimis, it's negligible, it's nothing to be concerned about. Well, first of all, that's not true. I mean, there are low-level exposures, chronic exposures that occur over time that can have a devastating effect. But in the case of endocrine disruptors, what has been found is that minute levels of exposure during critical windows of vulnerability, like pregnancy, developmental periods, growth spurts in life, that these chemicals act as estrogen mimics, and so they create a disruption in the development of the organ systems, which can affect cancer and all kinds of effects later in life. So it's exactly the opposite. It's minute doses at critical times that cause the effect, minute doses. And EPA doesn't really yet, I mean, they've been working on it, but they don't have in place the protocol to evaluate that, because their typical protocol is what's called a maximum tolerated dose experiment, in which they're using really high levels of exposure and trying to extrapolate them. And the reason they do that, I mean, there's a valid reason for doing that, is because, you know, if you try to, for instance, do a cancer study over the lifetime of the test animal, you'd have to keep a million animals alive. It's almost an impossible task. It's been tried. And you'd have to have a control group of a million animals, and then you'd have to, it's virtually impossible. So they do these high dose experiments over shorter periods of time, and they extrapolate from that. But that, you know what that means, that, and this is the reason that with carcinogens, we really, when you talk about what's an acceptable level of exposure, zero. There is no acceptable level of exposure. And in fact, Congress used to embrace this notion that there's no acceptable level of exposure to a carcinogen, and we should not allow any exposure to carcinogens in the market. And if you go back in the history and look at pesticide regulation law, that was the operating premise. The operating premise was also that there would never be pesticides in our water. And if you go back in history and look at this history, it actually happened on Long Island and in central Wisconsin, where Aldicarb showed up in the eastern part of Long Island, potato fields, that area, years ago. And it wasn't supposed to be there. And if you look at the early press reports on the incident, you'd see these quotes from the chemical industry. I think it was Union Carbide at the time saying, "Oh, that's an anomaly. That shouldn't be happening. These chemicals bind very tightly to organic matter, and they can't move through or leach through the soil." And in fact, that turned out not to be the case. And here we are, two decades later, and we have dozens, if not hundreds, of chemicals in our water, in our drinking water, mm-hmm. and we've attached so-called acceptable levels of exposure to those chemicals. So that, you know, that puts us in a situation where you've got a high degree of uncertainty just because of the nature of testing, you know, going from the laboratory to the real world. And in doing that, you realize you have some black holes, you have some data gaps. You can't really determine, because of these high-dose experiments, you can't really determine the point at which a chemical will induce a cancer or exacerbate a cancer, you know, through this type of experimentation. You can say, yeah, this is a chemical that is a carcinogen. It's a chemical that has high potency, low potency. But you can't tell us, or the scientists can't tell us, at what point you will induce or promote a cancer effect. And that's a huge problem. And that's why we, years ago, fought very hard to save something called the Delaney Clause, which was amended. And the Delaney Clause basically said that chemicals, carcinogens, should not show up in food. It was a quirky amendment, like many are. So if you could have a separate show on this, but the bottom line was it was focused on processed foods. And so the reality is that any food that comes off the farm, any commodity like a tomato or an apple, there's always a percentage of that crop that ends up in the processed market. It ends up as apple juice, or it ends up as tomato paste or tomatoes mm-hmm. in a can. And in that process, the carcinogens are showing up. So those processed foods, under law, which has now been repealed, under the law, no chemicals were allowed in that processed food. So that meant, working backwards, that the farmer, because every farmer, you know, that no farmer wants to lose the crop that doesn't make the cosmetic, you know, doesn't make the mark, doesn't meet the mark on cosmetic standards, mm-hmm. they're not going to just throw it out. They want to recoup at least even a lower price to go to the processed market. So that was driving the decision on how to grow crops. I'm not going to use a carcinogen if I'm not going to be able to market to the processed market.
The leftovers, right.
Yeah, so it had a great effect. Anyway, we're now left with a risk assessment process. And the risk assessment process is supposed to determine what those levels are that we're eating and drinking. And that risk assessment process brings with it a lot of uncertainty, a lot of unknowns. We talked about vulnerable population groups. We talked about endpoints like endocrine disruption. We talked about the lack of information on knowing the actual point of exposure that induces or promotes cancer. These unknowns are all part of the risk assessment. And when they show up, it's like, okay, we're gonna write that down as an uncertainty. And the risk assessor generally does do that, but it never makes it into the political speak or the press conference in which, oh, glyphosate is showing up in all our food, but the levels are safe. You know, that's the statement. Roundup, yeah, it might have some adverse effects, but the levels of exposure are safe. I have heard this for decades now, you know, with chlordane,
I'm sure you
with
have.
Chlorpyrifos.
I'm going to stop you for a minute because we need to take a couple-minute break. And when we come back, I want to make sure we have time to talk about this incredible conference you have coming up.
Okay.
So everyone who's listening, don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, the founder of the Progressive Radio Network. Today, we have more than 80 producers bringing forth the most progressive and most liberating information. The kind of information you do not regularly hear on any of the mainstream or alternative media. You can help us now Up to this point, I have virtually supported the Progressive Radio Network, all of its expenses and payroll, myself. But we would like to expand our reach. We'd like to do far more. We'd like to be able to advertise on Facebook and let others know we exist. We are the number one progressive radio network in the world. In fact, we have programs that are most listened to in all of progressive radio. But we could go a lot further. Our message can reach a lot more people, especially at a time when people are desperate for honest, objective insights on the important topical issues of our day. How can you help? It's simple. Go to prn.fm, go to our main page. In the upper right-hand corner, you'll see a little button, Support Now. And then whatever you can contribute on a monthly basis will make a big difference. It will help get the message out. It will help inform more people, give them more choices. This is where you'll hear in the independent candidates and the people looking to challenge the corruption in government and industries. But we need to get our reach out further. So please, whatever you can afford on a monthly basis, and there's some suggestions there, and it'll be automatic. All right? Thank you very much for continuing to help us help you and the rest of the world on these important issues.
A gadget guy, but I love gadgets that really do the trick, like the new app. The Progressive Radio Network has an app, thanks to our friends at Audio Now. Hey, this is Mark Farrell, host of Insight on Thursdays at 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, where we broadcast live out of New York City. But if you can't catch the show live, no frets. It's always archived. It's always on the app. Download it now, listen later, whenever you want. The Progressive Radio Network app is available from our friends at Audio Now. Check it out.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani and I.E. Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And if you're just joining us, my guest today is Jay Feldman, the Executive Director of Beyond Pesticides. And we're just talking about a conference that's coming up this next weekend. Hey, yeah. Jay. So tell us about this conference you have coming up.
Yeah. You know, the conference is split into two parts. A lot of what I've been talking to you about on the regulatory side, the science, what do we know, what don't we know, what are the adverse effects, what are the uncertainties. We talk about that in the conference on Saturday in the morning. And the reason we do this is because our role, as we see it as an organization, is to empower folks to be effective advocates at the community level for the sole purpose of advocating the transition away from toxic chemical use. And so that's why we spend the second half of the conference really focused on organic practices, because organic really is a systems change. It's a different way of treating the soil, of understanding the value of nature, respecting nature for not only what it offers us, you know, in terms of life-giving properties, but also its ecosystem services. And for, I'll just give a quick example. You know, if you have a typical lawn in the suburbs and you're following conventional practices, you're probably using something called weed and feed, or you're using a synthetic fertilizer, which is a soluble form of nutrients feeding the plant, and then you're putting down an herbicide, a weed killer, to kill the dandelions or something like that. Well, with an organic system, you begin from the understanding that there are microorganisms in the soil. There's beneficial bacteria, beneficial fungi, and those organisms break down organic matter, which then cycle nutrients and make them available to the plant material. So the plant, you know, so essentially you have nitrogen cycling through that system naturally. We're ignoring that whole process when we put a synthetic fertilizer down. And all of this has been incorporated into organic food production, which starts with management of the soil. And so we talk about these issues and basically bring in folks who have been successful in transitioning schools, universities, parks, playing fields, to organic land management. And this year, you know, every year is different. We move the conference around the country, have tremendous speakers on this point. A guy that transitioned Harvard Yard started out as part of a study, and now they've gone school-wide on organic land management practices. And the guy, just coincidentally, the guy who managed as a senior scientist Arnold Arboretum at Harvard, and now emeritus, teaches a class on ecology and planning at MIT, and has written a book, the book, on urban plants in the Northeast, who has some really fascinating information and background and expertise on how to manage open spaces and forested areas, because, you know, a lot of chemicals are used in that context as well. So it really, I think, is an incredible opportunity for folks to get to feel comfortable in this whole, which sometimes sounds like a complex issue, you know, to really boil it down, feel like you can go to your town board, your city, and begin talking to them about transitioning away from toxic chemicals. This is not an academic conference. This is a take action. How do we become more effective? So in the case of New York City, we've been working with local community groups there that are pushing policy that would transition all the parks in New York City to organic land management. And the councilman member behind that, Councilmember Ben Callis, will be there as well. The other exciting part of this conference is the number of urban farmers that will actually be coming to the conference. And these are folks that have been working, we might call them gardens, but they really qualify as farms in the inner city, growing food, using organic practices, from the Brooklyn Grange, working on rooftop gardens, to Green City Forest, which is working with the New York City Housing Authority on 8 urban farms on public housing property. Fascinating mm-hmm. stuff. We'll be hearing from the youth that work with those projects and have gone on to do other work in agriculture, in education, what their experiences were and how they learned and what they learned, you know, over those years working on those project. Mm-hmm.
So you said the Saturday morning is going to be talking mostly about the pesticides and how right. you can take action. What is Friday's focus?
Well, Friday is our introduction. Okay, so Friday, starting at 4:30, we have a session on pesticide effects, the media and science, by some really preeminent folks that have studied this and worked on these issues for years. That's sort of our introductory, we consider really a pre-conference session, because that's the opportunity to really get the background, you know, understand some of the stuff we've just talked about on the regulatory side, also issues around the media and working with the media. Then we have a reception, and then after that, Joan Gussow, who's considered the matriarch of local food, author of about 7 books, also served on the National Organic Standards Board, and was the chair of the Nutrition School at Columbia University, grew all her own food for decades. And
She's been a guest on my show. Yeah, she's great.
Oh, phenomenal person. So uh-huh. she'll be there on Friday evening, along with these guys who have worked at Harvard and really have a model program for the country. But they've gone way beyond that. I mean, both Tredici, Peter Del Tredici, and Eric T. Fleischer have had projects in New York City. And so a lot of this is both relevant to what's actually going on in the city as well as outside the city and around the country, in New York State and around the country. Now, the mm-hmm. bonus here.
Okay, so we are just about out of time. So let's just tell everybody where this wonderful conference is. It's going to be at the New York Academy of Medicine. That is Uptown. What, do you have the actual address of that?
103rd and 5th Avenue.
103rd and 5th Avenue. Yeah. And it starts on Friday and is all day on Saturday as well. And then it
and
ends
we have a
with
film,
a premiere film
right. on Saturday evening at 55 East 59th Street on Ground War, which is a fascinating film about the filmmaker's search to understand his father's cancer. An avid golfer, he ends up talking to community activists that pass policies and an organic golf course on Martha's Vineyard. So a fascinating film, and we'll have a panel discussion with the guy who won the first landmark lawsuit, the Lee Johnson against Monsanto. He will be there to talk about his lawsuit.
Great.
Yeah, that's
great.
Saturday night, 7:30 at the Florence School Theater at 55 East 59th Street. And you can come to that free if you're coming to the conference, or it's a $10 entry. 7:30 Saturday night.
Wonderful. Jay, thank you so much, and thank you for your work, for your lifelong work in this field. It is so necessary, and it's also so necessary for us all to fight to get someone good in the Environmental Protection Agency. That's why when they put these industry people in charge of this government, it just makes me crazy. So,
and thank you for your work and the work you're doing. It's incredible and important. Thank you.
Thank you. Everyone out there, have a great rest of the week. Hope to see you at that conference, and I'll be with you again next Thursday. Bye for now.